The Anesthesia Podcast.
Today we're going to take you on a journey from operating theatre efficiency to managing anticoagulation medication in patients with hip fractures, with a slight detour to answer the age-old question. When you're using a hyperangulated video laryngoscope, should you use a stylet or a bougie? Welcome to the June edition of the Anesthesia Journal Podcast. My name is Marianne Turner and I'm an editor at Anesthesia. I'm recording from the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I acknowledge their elders past and present, and I extend that respect to our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander viewers. Joining me today is Professor Kareem El-Boghdadli, our Senior Editor of Anesthesia Journal. Kareem, how are you?
Lovely to see you, hear you, Marianne, as always. Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks.
Excellent. Now, for those listeners who haven't had the good fortune to meet you yet, I wonder if you could give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself.
I am Kareem. I'm an anaesthetist in London, London, England. For those Canadians, when I was living in Toronto, I would always say London. They say, oh, London, Ontario. But actually London, England. I work at Guy's and St. Thomas's, Cleveland Clinic, London, and I am an honorary reader at King's College, London as well. My interests are researchy stuff, airway stuff, regionally stuff, and just general anesthesia related stuff.
Sure, just all those really small areas of anesthesia. So let's just cut to the chase, Kareem. Start with the big question. Stylet or bougie?
Oh, that's a question I wasn't anticipating, Marianne. You're right. It's an age-old question. And that's what this group here, G and Kim, tried to answer, actually, as many people have tried to do. So these guys, they did a randomized control trial and they randomized patients who are having tracheal intubation with a glide scope. So that's a hyperangulated blade video laryngoscope. So either a stylet to help facilitate tracheal intubation or a bougie. And their primary outcome was first pass success or successful tracheal intubation at the first attempt. They had a bunch of other secondary outcomes as well, some of which are a bit more interesting than others. And this group, and in this study, which included 160, 170 odd patients, they found that you are far more likely to be successful at tracheal intubation with a bougie than you are with a stylet. So 98% success versus 88%. Which I think is a substantial difference. So, you know, that's a difference of 10%. So if I am intubating 10 patients a day, as one of those patients that I'm not going to be successful with in terms of difference between the two groups. I can't answer it. Your question just yet, Marianne, but that's what this group found.
Excellent. Thank you. And I think more than a few of our readers were really surprised at the outcome of this study. Some of the commentators on Twitter sort of said the wrong stylet was used. Others referred to the wrong shape of the stylet. What are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are Twitter is a great place to get people's irritations and to work out what really, really bugs people. That's my first thought when you said that. My second thought is, there's stylets in different shapes and designs, right? So with the GlideScope, actually, the company actually manufactured a stylet that's designed to be used with the video laryngoscope. It's called the GlideRite stylet, but lots of people don't use that. But the key with a stylet is once you've inserted it into the tracheal tube, you can't really change the shape of it once you've started to intubate the patient's trachea. So the shape that you've got it in when you go in is the shape that it's going to be in, regardless of what that patient's anatomy or airway look like. And people have moaned and complained that, you know, the issue with this study was that they used the hockey stick shape. And yes, rightly so, people have gotten a bit irritated at that because there's lots of different types of hockey stick. I used to play ice hockey, little known fact. In Saudi Arabia, and I'm not lying, I played at a national level in Saudi Arabia, ice hockey. So ice hockey sticks have a very different shape to field hockey sticks. So yes, it is debatable whether the shape they used actually led to a worse outcome for patients with stylet. But the reality is, Marianne, is people use different shapes. I mean, there's no fixed shape that we all know works for every different laryngoscope. So some people will use a variety of hockey stick shapes. some people will just bend the stylet, you know? So it's really difficult in some regards. Yes, maybe the title of the paper should have said with a stylet in an English field hockey stick shape, perhaps. But it is real life. You know, some people do it in some form of hockey stick shape and some don't.
One of the other things that I found really interesting in this paper was about what the primary outcome was. I mean, something that we're really interested in at the journal is clinically relevant papers that can, you know, with clinically relevant outcomes, does the primary outcome matter? You know, should it have more of a patient focus, or is first pass tracheal success rate, first pass intubation success rate, what is important?
Yeah, I mean, in some regards, they're both important, really, because you want to be successful with your first attempt, because we know the more attempts that you have, the more likely you are to have complications, the more difficulty you may face in intubating the patient's trachea and further airway management. So yes, first attempt tracheal intubation success is an important outcome. Thankfully, they didn't choose time to tracheal intubation, which is a really unimportant outcome, and no one really cares about that. And it's just not a real outcome that anyone is humongously excited by. But really, the outcome, if I was a patient, as you know, we had talked about before, if I was a patient, I wouldn't care how many times that it took to intubate me, as long as they were successful with my intubation. And when I woke up, I could eat, I could swallow, I could talk. And I didn't have a numb face or didn't have a tracheostomy in the front of my neck, really. So from a patient's perspective, maybe those other outcomes might be more important. And I know there are secondary outcomes here, you know, sore throat, hoarseness, dysphagia, secondary outcomes. But also, maybe we should be thinking about prioritizing outcomes that are relevant to patients and powering studies to these sorts of outcomes.
Yeah, I think all of our patients would 100% agree with that. Moving on, theatre efficiency. I love talking about ways to improve theatre efficiency and health economics. So what can you tell us a bit about this second paper that we've decided to discuss?
Yeah, no, this is a great paper of a study that was done in the States with a really, really diverse authorship group. And what they did is they wanted to work out how you could reduce cancellation rate, be a little bit more efficient with patients actually turning up for surgery, scheduling appropriately. And they did a couple of really simple interventions. So firstly, is they did patient assessment, which is a good thing. So they taught surgeons to assess patients, by getting surgeons to just ask a few simple questions. They then, a part of that assessment also included stratifying patients. So deciding, really, does someone who has absolutely nothing wrong with them, who's presenting for a really basic ambulatory procedure, do they need to go through all of these complex processes of, you know, turning up, nurse assessment, swabs, bloods, yada, yada, or can we just filter out and focus our risk assessment on those higher risk patients? And then the other thing they did, which also seems quite simple, is communicate with patients and say, by the way, you've got surgery coming up. By the way, don't forget, you've got an operation via text messages. And I thought that was actually super, super simple and super obvious. You know, I've got the mind of a goldfish, the memory of a goldfish, and it's likely that I will forget many things. But the amazing thing about just reminding patients that they have surgery is, you know, before the intervention, they did it before after assessment, right? But before the intervention, 7% of patients forgot to turn up for surgery. I don't know if they forgot or not, but they just did not turn up for surgery. Just missed appointment. And I thought that was bonkers, really. I mean, if I had surgery, I would like to think that I would remember or I would turn up. Of course, the reasons are multifactorial and everyone's got life to deal with. But so fundamentally, they did a before after assessment, before these reasonably simple interventions and after these interventions. And they found that these interventions saved them money, reduced case cancellation, made them more efficient.
Now, this was implemented in a hospital in the United States. Do you think that in healthcare systems such as the UK or Australia, where, you know, we've got a slightly different model, do you think these implementations are useful? And can we use them to improve efficiency and cost in our own centres?
Yeah, it's a good question. The generalizability of the data, right? It's really hard to implement anything new in the NHS. I don't know about in Australia, but in the NHS it is hard. But actually, But the truth is, they used an EHR, a patient medical record, which was Epic, And we've got Epic here in the UK, and there's a bunch of hospitals in the UK that have it, but it doesn't matter what a medical record software you have, that most of them allow you some way, shape, or form to do a patient assessment. And what these guys did is they did some deep learning algorithms to develop a way to screen patients and say, this patient is low risk, intermediate risk, high risk. These are the patients that need to be seen. And I think that that is something that is, if you've got an electronic health record, should be doable. And then the other thing that I think is doable is, you know, push notifications to patients. So engaging patients by communicating with them. And I think most places currently do that anyways. Most places with reasonably advanced health systems. Of course, there are some areas that are underserved and underdeveloped, and that's a very different story. And maybe this paper isn't generalizable to that population. But I think it's doable, and we should all think about doing it. It's such a simple, simple thing that they did: assess patients, mm-hmm. communicate with them, right? And they improved outcomes. So why not think about that?
It seems like something that we could all achieve, and the outcomes, you know, seem really excellent. So it is a shame that, yeah, it's I do wonder what systems will take up these opportunities to optimize. Now, how did they go about developing the algorithms? And sort of, it seems to me that there was, you know, potentially some sort of artificial intelligence involvement in this. What this is obviously a growing area. What do you think about the involvement of artificial intelligence in healthcare and optimization?
Yeah, so I'm not going to go through the mechanics and the detailed methodology of how they develop their deep learning algorithms, primarily because I haven't the foggiest, but secondarily because we've only got a short space of time on this podcast. But fundamentally, what they did is they taught the machines to look at the patients that had come in and looked at what category they were in terms of ASA physical status and comorbid status, and classify them as to low, medium, high risk. What I like about this is, you know, we've been talking about deep learning and AI for a long, 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 well, what feels like a long time. And we've been talking about how we can implement it in our day to day. But these guys actually have implemented it. They've actually gone on and implemented patient risk stratification. Now, I know certainly in the UK, there's a lot of partners with the NHS that are developing this. I mean, there's one company that are working in the UK, certainly. What they're doing is super interesting, is they are risk stratifying patients using their GP records. So when the patient is referred by the GP to the surgeon for a procedure, they've already been risk stratified at that point using AI and deep learning. But what this is showing us now is this is real life implementation of deep learning to help improve patient assessment and therefore help improve outcomes of some sort.
Now we're going to move on, Kareem, to our final paper for today, DOACs and hip surgery. Four consensus statements were made in this paper. Were you surprised by any of them?
I actually wasn't surprised by any of them. And that's probably a good thing, really. Recommendations that surprise you, or guidance or consensus recommendations that surprise you, can potentially be quite divisive and difficult to implement. So the nice thing about this is there's really very practical recommendations that they made, and they made four key recommendations. Well, four recommendations only. What I liked about this is they're quite pragmatic. You will note that every one of the four recommendations has the word reasonable or reasonably in it. So they want us to be reasonable clinicians, right? And I think that is quite telling. It's about being reasonable. Very little black and white in life. What these guys are doing is they're giving us a steer on which side of the gray they're going to be on. So peripheral nerve blocks can reasonably be performed on patients. Hip fracture surgery can reasonably be performed on patients on DOACs. GA can reasonably be administered, and it is generally reasonable to consider commencing DOACs within commencing surgery. These are all very practical recommendations, and they just empower us to really. What they're doing is they're emphasizing that patients with hip fractures, the most important thing is for them to have their surgery. right? They need to be operated on, and they're trying to minimize the reasons for delay and minimize the time patients are off their DOACs as safely as possible, so that the indication for the DOAC can be managed as safely as possible pre, intra, and postoperatively.
Now, one of the really interesting things that they were unable to make a recommendation about was spinal anesthesia. There's been loads of research in this area about spinal versus GA. Do you think we will ever get any evidence to support one approach over the other?
Oh, God. It's a difficult one because spinal versus GA is quite an emotive subject. I mean, I know lots of regional anesthetists who swear by spinal and think, how could all of these studies not definitively show? In fact, there was a study published in New England Journal a few years back, but the takeaway that everyone's just taken away from is there was no difference in outcomes. In some regards, that may be true. And there are others that are just GA, always GA, always GA, everyone, and it's fine. Again, the truth is somewhere in the middle. So it'll be very, very difficult for there to be a definitive study on the right patients, which are the higher risk patients, really. The lower risk patients, the younger patients, those that were quite able and mobile pre-hip fracture, those with a limited comorbid burden. That, I mean, most people would probably agree it's not likely that we'll find a difference. It's the higher risk patients. Now, the difficulty with the higher risk patients is with pragmatic studies, there are so many different interventions that people do to mitigate the adverse outcomes that patient may face, regardless of its spinal or GA. And because of that, I suspect that it'll be very hard for there to be a definitive trial that says one is better than the other. I suspect we will always have noise in the results, and we will always have uncertainty about one over the other in this setting. I like regional though, and I would try to do a spinal if I can, but I recognize that might not necessarily be perfect for everyone. But that's me as a personal opinion. But in terms of evidence base, it'll be challenging. Who knows, though?
Now, Corinne, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was the methodology behind these statements. The term Delphi is being used a lot these days in a lot of different areas. Can you explain to us what is Delphi and why is everybody obsessed with it?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's like a gazillion Delphi studies out there, and there almost needs to be a journal of Delphi studies. But the thing is, Delphis are super interesting. The whole idea of consensus is you need to find a way to synthesize the evidence, interpret the evidence, and there may be differences in people's interpretation of the evidence, and there may be times when there isn't no real strong evidence. So how do you make recommendations when there's a difference in the interpretation of the evidence, when there is insufficient evidence, or when there is no evidence whatsoever? And that's where Delphi comes in, right? Because it's a technique, and it's one of many techniques. There are other techniques that can be used, but this seems to be the one that has been has gained the most traction, is perhaps the most appropriate for making recommendations in clinical practice. The whole idea of a Delphi technique is you synthesize whatever evidence there is, you present the evidence to a bunch of stakeholders. Now, ideally, this needs to be as multidisciplinary as possible, different people, different views. And you go through various rounds where people vote and give their input or their opinion on a certain topic. So in this example is for this paper, the questions they asked was, let's take the first one, for patients presenting with hip fracture and are receiving DOAC, should a peripheral nerve block be performed on presentation? And so the participants in the Delphi, they were given all the evidence and they were given an opportunity to say yes, no, or vote on that. Based on that voting, a result comes back. So let's say 50% of people said yes, the other 50% said no. So there's obviously no consensus there. So then what happens with the Delphi is then you go through another round where you share the results from the previous round in a blinded fashion. So let everyone start to see what other people are thinking, interpret other people's views on things. And with multiple rounds, gradually over time, people will start to converge on something where they get consensus on. because they'll see people's views, they'll think again, they'll have an opportunity to air their views. And eventually, you will ideally have consensus on certain things. And you'll have consensus on things that don't have evidence for them. You'll have consensus on things that have insufficient evidence, and you'll have consensus on things that have no evidence. Of course, sometimes there can be no consensus. You will just never get people to agree, like spinal for GA, as we talked about. Yes. And that was one of the ones that they couldn't get people to agree. So that's the whole idea of Delphi, is to get consensus to make recommendations on something when it is perhaps a little bit difficult to do so.
Excellent. Thanks so much for explaining that, Corinne. And thank you so much for joining me today.
No, thanks very much. Always a pleasure to chat to you, Marianne. And it's a great issue, to be honest with you, the June issue. It was hard for us to choose three papers. But hopefully, the papers that we looked at today are nice and varied, something on a little bit, bigger picture, sorting out what we do in terms of efficiency and organizational challenges, something a little bit more clinical, hip fractures and various bits on the hip fractures, and something super technical, stylet versus bougie. I still like the bougie, by the way.
Look, I think the most exciting thing that I've learned today is about your previous ice hockey career in Saudi Arabia. So that was definitely a highlight for me.
Riyadh Oilers, just saying. Riyadh Oilers.
Go Riyadh Oilers. So for all of our listeners, links to the papers discussed will be provided with the podcast or can be found over on the Anesthesia Journal website. We would absolutely love to hear from all of you. So please join our online discussions on Twitter, or even better, submit some correspondence for publication. Thank you all for joining us today. And thanks again, Kareem.
Thanks, Marianne.
The Anesthesia Podcast.